Well, welcome, friends, to another episode of A Pastor and a Philosopher Walk Into a Bar. We're always excited to share this time with you and chat and just bring you into our heads and our world and our conversations. And today, literally, is going to be just bringing you into a conversation that Kyle and I had, and we stopped and said, wait a minute, we need to share this with our friends.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. That happened.
Yeah. Yeah. A couple days ago, we were talking, and Kyle talked about how Kierkegaard talked about the end of reason is the beginning of faith. Mm. Is that about what you'd say, Kyle?
Yeah, more or less. We're going to unpack that here in a few minutes. But yeah, and how my view of faith has changed over the years to become gradually closer to his, even though I resisted it at every turn. So mm-hmm. Yeah, and we thought, you know, this is something we should put on the podcast.
I think it's going to be fun. I'm excited about it. I'm also excited about what we're drinking. I don't know how many other people are going to be excited about what we're drinking, but I don't really care. When we started this podcast, I was mocked fairly openly by some people for being a lover of Pilsners. But I'm not just a lover of any kind of Pilsner. I'm the lover of European Pilsners. And there's something about European Pilsners that can't be duplicated no matter how hard Americans try. I've never met it. And for this episode, we have a great friend of ours. His name is Chris Johnson. He brews beer. He makes whiskey. Don't tell anyone.
Are we supposed to tell people that?
It's allegedly.
Yes, allegedly. So, Chris, welcome to A Pastor and a Philosopher Walk Into a Bar.
Thank you. You guys are so pretty.
All right. Let's see where this is going to go. All right. So, this is Pilsner Urquell. This is, I think, probably the best representative of European Pilsners. It's got the right amount of hops. It's clear, crisp. It's funky. Let's try it.
And we're drinking it out of a super tall Pilsner glass. For those of you who can't see, it's actually quite pretty.
Mm, yep. There it is.
Chris, why don't you tell us something about Pilsners?
So as far as Pilsners go, Chekvar is actually, and Pilsner Urquell is touted as one of the most original of the styles of Pilsner. It is a lager, so that means that it is fermented in lower temperatures with a specific yeast that is a lager yeast. The bitterness of this is not harsh, not like an IPA. It's fairly mild to match the malt profile. And this particular beer, I believe, is known for having a particular style of boiling the wort multiple times so as to get a particular caramelization out of the beer. This could be completely BS, but that's what I'm saying for now.
Fun. What do you think,
forever,
Kyle?
Because this is recorded. You know what? I don't hate it, which for a Pilsner is really saying something. I expected it to have no flavor whatsoever. And there is some. So
I think it's already better.
There's a lot of flavor in here.
Yeah. That's the thing about American Pilsners is, and lagers in general, I think, is that they're almost nothing to them. It's like drinking brown water.
Yeah. If you drink this compared to any American Pilsner, a Budweiser, a Miller Lite, or whatever, it's going to be completely different.
Well, the interesting thing is for me, there have been microbreweries, craft breweries, who've tried to replicate European Pilsners, and I've had a bunch of them because I'm like, it has to be able to be duplicated. I haven't had one.
Yeah.
Never.
Why?
And I tried for years. You know, as a home brewer, I tried for at least 3 to 5 years to try to replicate what I loved in a European lager. Couldn't do it.
What do you think it is that keeps them distinct?
I don't know. If I knew, I would get closer.
Obviously, no other Americans do either because
These aren't aged in any way. There's nothing about the terroir or the water available in certain places
It could be water. It could be the process. It could be a lot of things, but I haven't gotten close.
Weird.
Yep.
I will say they're very pretty to look at. They have the bubbles that just continue.
It's like champagne.
But you're not going to get in an ale.
So you don't hate it, huh?
I don't hate it.
All right. No. Good. I feel like you
wish I did. I wish I could say that it was terrible and you have no taste, but it's actually pretty good.
I mean, I think if God would make a beer, it would be close to this.
Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah.
I don't know if I'd go that far.
Well, Chris, thanks for joining us and being our resident beer expert. I'm sure, listeners, you can expect to hear more from Chris.
Thank you. And I would just like to say a very happy Pilsner Urquell to you all out there in podcast land.
Cheers.
You're like when someone's idea of a podcast is.
I've never listened to a podcast yet. I'm still waiting to find out from my son what a podcast is.
So, Kyle, as we've been talking about our faith journey, and particularly yours intermingled with your philosophical, I was going to say indoctrination.
Hopefully the opposite of that.
We'll find out. We'll find out. But you were speaking of Kierkegaard's studies on the end of faith and the beginning of reason and the, yeah. the marriage of faith and reason and how that works. And I want to hear more about that. So I'm just going to basically play host, ask you some questions, let you talk. Sure. And maybe...
Which is kind of how this started anyway, right?
I guess
just so. Just chilling, talking after one of our recording sessions.
Yeah.
Yeah, let's just have a conversation. So yeah. faith and reason is one of those huge topics in philosophy of religion. Like there's probably encyclopedia entries on it. If you go to some philosophy encyclopedia, it's just one of the main things that you learn about when you start studying that. So it's super old and everybody that's anybody in the history of philosophy has had something to say about it. My own journey on this issue started as an undergrad, I guess, when I was super into apologetics. This is something you and I have talked about before. And so I thought it was really important to defend the faith, right? I thought there were a lot of people out there who wanted to attack it and were asking all these hard questions. And I thought there was lots of Christians who like were desperate for answers to these sort of things. You know? And particularly lots of unchurched people who were desperate for it. I later came to realize that's largely a myth, right? There aren't that many people out there who care about that stuff. Unless you're like a 20-something white kid and like
that's exactly the only person who's interested in that in my world.
More or less, yeah. But it took me several years to figure that out. So my initial thinking, musings, I guess, on faith and reason were that they were almost the same thing, that I wanted to make faith super rational. Mm-hmm. And I was really concerned with critiques of Christianity as being irrational. In fact, just totally coincidentally today, you know how Facebook sometimes shows you what you posted, you know, on this day.
All mine are about my kids.
Yeah, well, it showed me today, on this day 10 years ago, you posted this blog post. And so I followed the link just to see what I had said and was reminded of how into this stuff I used to be and how, you know, I used to talk about faith as almost this proof-oriented, evidential, forensic thing to counter what I thought the atheists were saying, which some of them were saying, right? They were saying things like, faith is just believing in contradiction to the evidence or believing entirely without evidence. Hmm. That's the point of faith, if you listen to people like Sam Harris or Richard Dawkins or whatever. I later came to see that you ought not to form your theological beliefs in response to people like Sam Harris and Richard Dawkins, but at the time, that's what I was doing. And so I knew that faith couldn't be what they said it was. It couldn't be this anti-evidential thing where you only believe a thing if you have no good reason for it, or you have good reason against it and you believe it anyway. That can't be what faith is. If it is, I'm out, right? Because I'm a person that has a brain. So I was trying to make it really like evidential. It's this thing that you have good reason to believe God is a certain way, and then you step out in faith, meaning you do a thing based on your evidence, based on the belief that you have that God is that way. I later let go of that. I don't think faith is evidential anymore, and a huge reason for that is Kierkegaard, who says it's an entirely different sort of thing, which we can get into. But along the way, I had occasion to think a lot and write quite a bit about faith and how it's related to belief, or maybe how it's not related to belief. And so we can talk however much you want about any of that stuff. If you're interested in what current philosophers are saying about faith, I'm happy to fill you in on that. How it's related to belief, how it's related to other attitudes like trust or whatever.
Well, let me ask this. This is probably going to break our outline, but you're smart enough to go with the flow. I've heard a lot about Kierkegaard and have heard quotes from Kierkegaard, but what would Kierkegaard have to say as maybe a thesis statement to this conversation?
Ooh, that's interesting. He would be against thesis statements, I think, for one thing.
Kierkegaard.
Faith is subjective.
Okay.
Is one, I suppose, if we were going to pluck out a statement that's pithier than it sounds, that's one of them. Faith is subjective, meaning it's not objective, meaning it's not the sort of thing that can be understood in evidential terms or in argumentative terms or in really cognitive terms at all. Mm-hmm. If I'm setting out to understand with my reason, my relationship to God, then I'm already not aimed at faith.
Yeah, which
he would say.
Some people might be challenged by that idea. Yeah. To me, that just sounds obvious.
I sure was challenged by it. I mean, it's interesting that you think it's obvious. I certainly didn't, and I don't think most people do when they first encounter it, to say that faith is subjective and not objective is to say that trying to understand cognitively what God is like, trying to understand theology in the mode that theology is typically written and intended, trying to understand whether there are any objective reasons to believe that Christianity is true.
Mm-hmm.
If you're interested in more on truth, go listen to our episode on that. Those questions just don't come up for a sincere Christian, according to Kierkegaard.
Mm-hmm.
And insofar as they do come up, and insofar as those are your focus, you're not acting as a Christian.
Mm-hmm.
Kierkegaard would say it's something fundamentally other than that, which leads a lot of people to charge him with being a fideist, which means someone who thinks that faith is what those atheists thought, something that is fundamentally contrary to reason, which means you have to shut off your brain to be a Christian. I don't think that's the right way to interpret him. I think he's saying something richer and more interesting than that. But
so
you can see
though,
how people get there.
So he's saying, though, if you do try to make your faith concrete and objective, empirical, provable, you're actually playing into the atheist's hands.
Yeah, you're playing into their hands. But he doesn't care about that because he doesn't care about the whole apologetic effort at all. Here's where he's coming from, and hopefully this will hit home for a lot of our listeners, I think. So Kierkegaard was writing in Denmark, in 19th century Denmark, where the state religion is Christianity.
Mm-hmm.
So much like the contemporary United States, if you're born in the country, you kind of assume the religion of, you know, the people that you're around. In the United States, it's something like, what, 70% of Americans report being Christians or something like that. I don't know what it was in Denmark at the time, but probably similar, if not higher.
Yeah.
And so Kierkegaard is encountering all these people who think that because they're Danish, they're Christian. Mm-hmm. And so if you ask them, are you a Christian? They'll say, of course, I was born here.
Yeah.
Much like you might encounter, you know, an American and you ask them, you know, what's your religious background? They'll tell you the church they grew up in and say something that identifies them with a particular community and think that that answers the question, right? And so Kierkegaard was very concerned with what it took to actually become a Christian, to actually be one.
I like this.
And not just to be a member of a group, right, that sort of objectively identifies with a religious history or something, but to actually be a follower of Christ.
Mm-hmm.
So Kierkegaard is really concerned with trying to find a way to convince or to reveal to his fellow Danes that they're not Christians when they think they are. So at one point he describes his project as introducing Christianity to Christendom. So you it's like reverse evangelism.
I like it. I like it.
Right?
Yep.
Most Christians are
I like
focused
this a
on,
lot.
On making the rest of the world Christian. Kierkegaard thinks, well, how can we do that if we're not? And we're not even asking the question whether we are. And when you do ask the question, you're likely, and you can even get somebody to take it seriously, you're likely to get some kind of objective reply. Here are the evidences. Here are all the reasons that can be understood in a kind of objective way that I am a Christian, right? Look at the place I go on the weekends. Look at where I give my money. Look at my habits of reading this book. Look at the kinds of friends I have. Look at the causes I support. Look at the kinds of things I don't do with my genitals. You know, all the things here, right? Look at my ethical life.
That sounds
or look
very
at my
familiar.
Look at my aesthetic life. Look at the kinds of art that I imbibe and the kinds that I resist. And look at who I hang out with and who I don't. These are all these sorts of objective reasons, and Kierkegaard thinks they're all completely irrelevant because God doesn't need to exist for any of those things to be true.
Okay.
There's no real relationship with Christ implied by any of those things. And so Kierkegaard thinks if that's your orientation to Christ, then you're missing it entirely. Mm. You're just not a Christian. And he was totally fine with pointing that out. But he did it in a really interesting way. He did it in an indirect way. So this is one of the challenging things about reading Kierkegaard is that he doesn't just come out and say a thing. Very, very rarely does he do that. He writes under pseudonyms. So, you know, he'll write a really long book under one name saying something in great detail, like 1,000 pages arguing this point. And then he'll write another equally long book under a different name arguing the opposite. And in some places he'll claim that, okay, that author is a Christian, that author's not, and that author's trying to be, whatever. And so he writes pseudonymously. Very little of his work is under his own name. And part of the purpose of that was to lead people to the conclusions that he wanted them to draw, which was that they're not, in fact, Christians, more often than not, rather than trying to argue it directly, because he didn't think that would work. People are very rarely convinced by direct argumentation. If they're going to change their minds about anything, and screw their minds, if they're going to change their existential orientation, it's going to be because they thought through something on their own, came to see that their values were one thing when they should be a different thing, and they felt like the decision was theirs. Mm-hmm. How do you get people to do that?
Mm-hmm.
Super difficult. He thought the only way to do it is indirectly. Mm-hmm. You have to kind of lead them down a path, demonstrate for them, or help them demonstrate to themselves that something is the case.
Yep. So did Kierkegaard go to great labors and write thousands of pages to prove people aren't Christians or what a Christian should be? Did he do that because he was passionate about the pure form of Christianity that found in the Gospels, or did he do that because he found so many people around him in Denmark hypocritical? Did he do that because he was dedicated to something or another? Like, why go through such great pains to show his fellow countrymen you're not actually Christians?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think probably all of the above. I'm not an expert on Kierkegaard or the history of that. I know that he was influenced by the Hegelian philosophical tradition, and he wanted to kind of respond to that. And he was strongly influenced by the, you know, political nature of Christianity at the time in Denmark, and wanted to respond to that. At the end of the day, I think he was just a sincere Lutheran. He thought that you could have a relationship with this person, Jesus, and that faith was a gift of God, and that you're, you know, saved by grace, and that's a gift of God, and that what you believe and what you can prove and what you can explain, that these are all secondary and they can become idolatrous. I mean, I think the guy was just really trying to understand what it means to love God and to love other people.
Mm-hmm.
From a place where, you know, from a place of grace, I suppose.
Yep. So let's dive into this question or idea of Kierkegaard's notion of there is an end to reason, and that's kind of where faith begins. I know I'm butchering it as an amateur,
I think that's right. Yeah, I think he has a more expansive notion of reason than has become popular in the last, I don't know, century or so within philosophy. And not just philosophy, within economics and other fields too. I think he thinks of reason in a broader sense, but he definitely thinks that there's a limit to what your cognitive capacities can get you to as far as justifying a decision.
Which is unique for a philosopher, I want to say.
It's not unique, but it was unusual in the time, and it kind of spawned a tradition. So he's known as one of the fathers of existentialism, which I think we've mentioned before. Interestingly, probably the only famous theistic existentialist. Okay. All the later ones kind of rejected that part of his thought and held on to some other parts.
What does it mean to be an existentialist?
Okay, so that's a huge question. So the real sort of cut and dry quick answer is that it means to focus on questions that are live to actually existing people prior to sort of metaphysical or more traditional questions. So Kierkegaard thought, for example, that to be a Christian, which is kind of his orienting concept, he wants to understand what it means to be a Christian. He wants to understand what it means for God to be a human, like these very basic Christian ideas. The live questions for a Christian, he thinks, are how can I, as just a normal human person with all the kinds of desires I have and all the weaknesses and frailties I have, how can I do that impossible thing of being like Jesus? Mm-hmm. That, he thinks, is the live question that you should ask as a religious person. And you should ignore or maybe even be a little hostile to the kinds of questions that often get discussed in scholastic theology or in, you know, mainstream philosophy of religion. You know, what is the Trinity like? Or what does it mean for Jesus to have a dual nature?
Can you lose your faith?
Yeah, you know, what is predestination? Let's work that out. Or, you know, in his own Lutheran tradition, there'd be many examples of that sort of thing too. What's sola scriptura, or what's whatever. These are cognitive questions that might be interesting. Maybe we can get to the bottom of them, maybe we can't, but they're not the essence of Christianity.
Yeah.
And if you get bogged down in them, it's really easy to ignore the essence of Christianity. It's even worse than that. It's really easy to think you've gotten the essence of Christianity because you've been able to explicate those other questions. And for Kierkegaard, it's just not what it's about. It's about, can you make this decision? Mm-hmm. Decisions lead to action. So to be a Christian means you've decided to make Christ your Lord, mm-hmm. right? To follow him, to try to become Christ-like, to accept the gift of grace, despite your own sinfulness. He's like any Lutheran, big on the idea of sin. And so, yeah, whether or not you can understand that or explain it or argue for it or justify it or whatever, just irrelevant. It might actually get in the way. And so he wants to, again, kind of indirectly lead people into the realization that all the things that they were kind of leaning on to make them feel like good, qualified Christians, religious people, whatever, that those were always vacuous and probably misleading.
Friends, before we continue, we want to thank Storyhill BKC for their support. Storyhill BKC is a full menu restaurant, and their food is seriously some of the best in Milwaukee. On top of that, Storyhill BKC is a full-service liquor store featuring growlers of tap available to go, spirits, especially whiskeys and bourbons, thoughtfully curated regional craft beers, and 375 selections of wine. Visit StoryhillBKC.com for menu and more info. If you're in Milwaukee, you'll thank yourself for visiting Storyhill BKC, and if you're not, remember to support local. One more time, that's StoryhillBKC.com.
This is fun. I've heard like little shadows and hints of Kierkegaardian philosophy and, dare say, theology, but I haven't known anything about what he actually thought. But I just know this resonates with my experience. I've had way too many conversations as a pastor about people asking, can you lose your faith? Or is the Bible inerrant? Or what does it mean mm-hmm. to, you know, all these things. And I've gotten to a point where I just want to, I hope you're not listening if you've asked me those questions before, but I want to just say it doesn't matter. Like those questions don't matter.
Well, they might not matter. They probably don't matter for most people, right? I don't think he would say they couldn't matter. If there are things that really do come from like your being and they keep you up at night and they're keeping you from embracing Christ, whatever. Sure. But how often does that
happen? Yeah, no, I mean, mostly we're just trying to win an argument or, you know, but here's what matters. How do I act like Jesus? How do I manifest the incarnation and life of Christ in my life, in my world, in my neighborhood? Those are the things that matter.
There is a little bit, I think there's something in Kierkegaard to make everyone uncomfortable, including you and me.
I'm sure.
So there are things we've complained about in evangelicalism before that are, there's a kernel of them within Kierkegaard's thoughts. So the idea that one ought to have a personal relationship with Jesus, that there ought to be some kind of conversion experience. He likes the idea that Christianity is an individual relation to an infinite being.
I agree
with that. So if we can borrow the idea from Martin Buber, I don't know if you ever read Buber, that the relationship to God is always second person. It's never a relationship to an idea. It's never a relationship to a community. It's never, you know, we, it, or anything like that. It's always I, thou. That's Buber's phrase. Mm-hmm. So my relationship to God is very much like my relationship to you, Randy, and not the idea of Randy, right? Not somebody's ideas about Randy, but you, the person, and all the complexity and whatever that goes into that relationship. Faith for Kierkegaard is a second person relation to God, because God is a person, Jesus, you know? And you can be in a relationship with that person, and you don't have to understand the relationship that you're in to be in it. You don't have to be able to explain it to anyone else. In fact, if your default in understanding the relationship is your ability to explain it to someone else, you probably don't have a very good relationship, right? If I think of my love for my wife in terms of all the good qualities about her, or my ability to justify my living with her to someone else, probably don't have a great relationship with my wife. That's a weird orientation. So
So did Kierkegaard frustrate a lot of his contemporaries?
Yeah, he sure did.
And I'm talking philosophers.
Yeah, for a long time. And even today, he's kind of relegated to the margins. Like, not a lot of people study him directly. People are interested in him for his historical influence more than anything else. The existentialists that followed him mostly were atheists and really didn't understand him, and so took the parts that they liked from his pseudonyms and chucked the rest of it. Didn't read his own thought, his journals, or anything like that. Certainly weren't interested in his Christianity. So, yeah, he's been largely misunderstood and ignored, unfortunately.
Yeah. Okay. So you mentioned this word fideism. Is that it?
Yeah, fideism.
Tell us about that.
Yeah, that word faith, right? Fides in Latin is faith.
Okay.
So it's this idea, and it's one of those pejorative terms. Nobody ever uses it for themselves. Like, nobody says, hey, I'm a fideist. Mm-hmm. It's like you accuse someone else of being it when they seem to be irrational. So there are several thinkers, Kierkegaard being prominent among them, who have suggested things, Luther as well, who have suggested things that sounded to other people as though they were shutting their brains down.
Okay.
And so admitting that the evidence points in the other direction, but faith is the kind of stubborn refusal to admit where the evidence points. I don't think that's what Kierkegaard is saying. Mm-hmm. I don't think most of the people accused of being fideists are actually saying that. That would be a kind of cognitive suicide.
Yeah.
But he is saying faith is more than what your reason can do. Faith is something that kind of begins when your reason has reached its limits. Mm-hmm. Faith is something that is in its practice can be inconsistent with the practice of your reason, because reason would then be trying to kind of fill a space that it's not qualified for. If I'm trying to be a Christian, to follow Christ by thinking about stuff real hard, then I'm probably less likely to actually be able to act in faith.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's just not what it was kind of cut out for.
But he wasn't advocating for a brainless
Christianity. No, I don't think so. There's debate about that in Kierkegaard's scholarship, but I come down firmly on the side that no. He would, I think, in my mind, align with people like William James, who is an American philosopher, who says, look, reason can take you pretty far, and if you ever have, say, evidence that points in one direction, you should follow that. But there are many questions that are live questions, meaning they're important to people, and they're momentous questions, meaning they're the kind of questions where you have to make a decision on them and you can't delay.
They keep you up at night.
Yeah, they're important to almost everybody, and you can't just put them off. To put them off is to make a decision. And one of those questions is religion or God's existence. Am I going to live in accordance with, you know, the plan of a higher being or not? And James says, look, when it comes to those kinds of questions, often the evidence is indecisive. So we can do our best to look into it, but it's not actually going to compel us in one direction or another.
That's not the way to go about it.
Yeah, even if you want it to. If you're intellectually honest, you're going to get to a place where you realize, wow, those really smart people over there in that other religion, or those really smart atheists over there, they have just as much reason for their view as I have for mine. And so I'm either going to suspend judgment or I'm going to make a decision, and this is a forced choice. I can't suspend judgment because that is making a decision. So I would put Kierkegaard in the camp that says that's where faith begins.
Okay.
When you have that kind of equilibrium evidential situation. And so then I'm saying, okay, I don't know for sure. I also don't have strong evidence to the contrary, and I have to do something. Am I going to open myself up to the possibility that there's a person out there that wants to be in communion with me? And I can, even that's not quite enough, though. So Kierkegaard says, even once I've come to that point and I've recognized that the next step beyond my reason is going to be required for me to understand this religion thing, understand in kind of a loose sense, right, a non-cognitive sense, that's still not quite yet faith, because I can approach religion aesthetically. I can approach it as an artist would approach it, right? I can build fancy cathedrals full of all kinds of wonderful art, and I can go through these elaborate liturgical routines, and I can be totally fulfilled by that for 80 years and die and never approach faith. Mm-hmm. Or I can approach it ethically. Mm-hmm. I can take it to be sort of a program for improving the world, like concretely, and I can give my money to certain charities, and I can spend my time in service of orphans, and I can whatever. And I'm still not approaching faith in those modes. So Kierkegaard is famous for his kind of three-tier life stages, I guess. When we talked with Brian McLaren, he mentioned Kierkegaard in his book as having sort of a stage view of existence. You start in the aesthetic, you move to the ethical, because you realize there's something more important than how beautiful things are. Mm-hmm. And some people then move to faith and many don't. And so for some of his pseudonyms, they end in either the aesthetic stage or the ethical. After like 1,000 pages, they're still just stuck in the ethical and they never get beyond it because they recognize in order to get beyond it, I'm going to have to accept some gift that's completely external to me and step out of my own categories, aesthetic or ethical categories. And I'm either unable or unwilling to do that. So Kierkegaard thinks when faith starts, it's a decision to receive grace rather than to be what he calls offended. Because there's an offense to the Christian idea that the infinite could become finite. Hmm. It's offensive to your reason because it seems like a contradiction. It's offensive to your ethical sense because then God could command a thing that you don't understand. It might be offensive to your aesthetic sense. So once you've understood Christianity, Kierkegaard says you're confronted with something offensive. You either take offense, and the result of that, he thinks, is despair, or you embrace it and you step out in faith, take the leap. That some people know him for that phrase, the leap of faith. He doesn't mean a leap into the abyss with, like, you know, nothing to stand on. He just means you're sort of venturing beyond any of those senses that people normally operate in.
Now, that's interesting because I never have looked at the incarnation and taken offense to it. Maybe this is because I grew up in the Christian faith and am used to it. But for me, the incarnation was one of the most beautiful things about our faith tradition.
Sure. And I think he would agree with that. He might also say, if what you love about it is its beauty, then you've missed it. Or if that's the mode that you primarily approach it in, then that's probably not faith. It's offensive in a few ways. It's offensive to reason in the sense that God simply couldn't be not God.
I could see the...
You know?
Well, that's a whole nother thing, because whether Jesus was not God, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, this, the idea that, like, the creator of all that is somehow now part of all that is. He wrote a few books trying to, like, make sense of that and failing. This is one of the indirect things he likes to do. He'll take the posture of someone who's sincerely trying to understand a Christian doctrine and make attempt after attempt after attempt to understand it and fail every time, and then that's the end of the book.
Sounds wonderful.
Yeah, yeah. So he has, his most famous book is probably Fear and Trembling, which is this guy who's not a Christian or a Jew trying to understand Abraham and how Abraham could be the father of faith, and how what it means for the clearest expression of faith to be your willingness to kill your son. And so this person tries and tries and tries and fails and fails and fails and never really comes to understand faith because you can't understand it from the outside. Something I talked about in one of our deeper dives. So it's offensive in that sense. There are things that Christianity commits you to that are offensive to my ethical sensibilities. I have an idea of the way I think the world should be, and I want to say that that's consistent with the character of God. But I can't fully justify that. I can't fully argue for that because God's also beyond my categories. So there are various ways that it becomes offensive, but mostly it's because it's kind of outside my control, I think. At least this is how I interpret him. For Kierkegaard, there's, like, he takes really seriously this idea that faith is a gift. It's not something you can get to on your own. It's something that is given to you from the outside and that can only kind of be understood and practiced from the inside.
It's not something you can get to on your own, he would say. That's interesting.
Yeah.
Because that flies in the face of a lot of modern Protestantism, at least, that says faith is my choice. It's the badge that I get to put on that says that I'm justified by faith and I was given grace, you know, all that.
Which might just be a misunderstanding of those Protestant thinkers. I mean, I think Kierkegaard is pretty orthodox on that idea, that, yeah, faith is a gift of God. You're dead in your sin. There's no way you could have achieved it on your own. Your job is to accept it or not accept it. I think that's pretty consistent, at least with Lutheranism. It's pretty consistent. Yeah, so he says a lot of things that should upset a lot of people, depending on where you come from. It's kind of an equal opportunity offense that you get from him. Like, he thinks that faith isn't primarily about belief, because belief is cognitive, right? Which is somewhere I eventually got to kind of independently, and then read Kierkegaard and thought, oh, okay. I was not the first to think that. This was, you know, hundreds of years old, this idea. Belief could just be irrelevant. It could actually get in the way of faith. Maybe it's even possible to disbelieve and have faith. I've argued for that personally. I think that it's if faith is more a relation to a person, a sort of decision that one makes, an action procedure, you commit yourself to certain practices, to a way of life, to living in a loving orientation towards people. I think all that's consistent with disbelief in doctrines or even in the existence of God. So, you know, I've argued
that. What do you mean consistent with?
It can happen simultaneously.
Okay, but you're not saying that, like, it makes more sense to disbelieve in God
following
the way of Christ.
No, but I am saying the belief isn't necessary and isn't a proper part of the faith, actually. That would be my claim, which is pretty unusual, pretty unorthodox historically, that faith is a gift and that anything that's any orientation towards it that's not approaching it as a gift that you didn't earn, that you didn't get to on your own, that you didn't understand, that's just ethics or aesthetics or something like that. It's something that any atheist could do. That faith is non-objective. We talked about that. That, you know, trying to understand Christianity by, like, figuring out the science and the metaphysics of the resurrection, or did the resurrection happen historically, that's fundamentally a wrong orientation. This one is something that should really bother Americans, that being from a Christian country is no help at all to being a Christian, that in fact there's no such thing as a Christian country, because the only sort of thing that could be a Christian is a person, an individual person, and that you're much more likely to fail to be a Christian if you come from a Christian country, because you're less likely to see that. He has a really interesting story where he loves metaphors and analogies and things, and they're often very creative, and he talks about, you know, somebody from a Christian country and somebody from a pagan country, and one prays in truth and one prays in falsehood, meaning thinking that they're, you know, praying to the correct God because they're from this place or whatever, but arguing that the pagan who prays in truth is actually the one with faith and the other one is. That's a familiar idea to many of us. And that faith is not religion, or as he calls it, religiousness. It's not just practices. It's not just liturgy. It's not just beliefs, as we said. It's, yeah, I don't know. It's something that can't be explained objectively. It's a personal, subjective relation to Christ that will then entail lots of actions, right? And it will entail love and whatnot. But yeah, because if it's just religiousness, again, you don't need God for that. kind of comes back to that. The people who are kind of fond of condescending to the spiritual, not religious crowd, which I've encountered a few times from like theological types that I've known, they'll, you know, roll their eyes and say, oh God, Christianity is a religion, get over it. What does it even mean to be spiritual but not religious? But a more compassionate take, and I think a more Kierkegaardian take, is that there's a deep truth there, that to be Christian is in many ways distinct from being religious. One can be religious to whatever degree you want and never approach Christian faith.
I find this super helpful in just thinking about the Christian world that we live in, which, I mean, Kierkegaard did and would, I think, probably could critique the crap out of it, but this notion that it's harder to be a Christian in a Christian nation, in a quote-unquote Christian nation, is so good, and it's so gospel-centric, where you see Jesus speaking to the religious elite and calling them whitewashed tombs and, you know, I mean, just scathing critiques. And then looking at not even just the religious leaders, because we like to hammer on the Pharisees, the Sadducees, the the gatekeepers. But then he looks at the Jewish people and calls them children of the devil. And they're like, are you kidding me? We're children of Abraham. And he's like, doesn't matter what your lineage is. Yeah. You're clearly a child of the devil.
Mm-hmm.
Jesus, Kierkegaard is channeling that inner Jesus stuff. Right there, right?
Yeah, this goes back to something Nick said in our previous episode. Like, when you read Jesus, you get a sense, like just reading the Gospels, the sort of red text, so to speak, mm-hmm. or even the sort of extra-canonical sayings of Jesus, the things like you get in the Gospel of Thomas. Like, Christianity's really hard. Mm-hmm. Following Jesus is hard, and he doesn't try to make it easier for anybody.
No.
More often than not, he counters their thinking that it's easy or that it can be accomplished in a religious liturgical way with making it impossible. It's easier for a rich person to go through the eye of a needle than mm-hmm. to make it to the kingdom of heaven. Or
unless you've eaten of my flesh and drink of my blood, exactly. You cannot be my disciples. Everyone leaves. And then he looks at his disciples and say, hey, everyone else left. Are you going to go too?
Yeah.
He almost says it in like a...
Yeah.
He's not super sad about it kind of way.
Or yeah, at least, you know, not surprised. I mean, I get it. Because in many ways, in many senses, the reasonable thing to do is leave when you realize what it costs.
Yeah.
And when you realize that the evidence is indecisive. Why would you put all of your effort and all of that expense and all of that sacrifice into something that you can't be sure of? It makes sense to leave. And Kierkegaard is in many ways following in that tradition of making Christianity harder for people.
Mm-hmm.
His evangelism is like, it's like the worst kind mm-hmm. as far as like success in church building, right?
Yep.
It's, you're going to have to sacrifice everything for this thing that you can't understand, and it might not pay off in the end.
And hopefully, I'd like to think...
Want
to
sign on?
Right. I think the people who might have a hard time with this might be some of the pastors who may or may not listen. But I'd like to think most of us would just agree with that on a fundamental level. Like, we've made Christianity too easy. Like, we've taken the edge off of Christianity. We've made Christianity into a pop culture sort of thing that is a bracelet I wear and a pop culture, basically, instead of this radical way of living in the way of love, instead of this subversive way that says, I cannot give my allegiance to the empire that I live in because my allegiance belongs 100% to Christ and his kingdom. These are things that are just, it's just, if you're reading the Bible, it's clear. There's just no arguing that this is what it means to follow Jesus. We've just made it so easy and simple and palatable to follow Jesus. You sign on the dotted line, and then you're good to go, and he'll give you everything you want. I think most of us listening resonate with this. Like, mm-hmm. yeah, this is the way of Jesus. It makes sense. And I'd like to be inspired to live more in this way rather than this civil religion that I've been given.
Yeah. Yeah, I hope you're right about that. I wonder what Kierkegaard would think if he were alive today and able to sort of see the current state of the American church, if he would be encouraged by the, you know, millennials and Gen Zers and whatever who seem, I think, a little dissatisfied mm-hmm. with mm-hmm. that kind of, I don't want to say organized religion. I hate that phrase as though, organization is a bad thing. But like, they definitely seem dissatisfied with the kind of easy Christianity where it's just a social club and you can sign up or not sign up and you can do certain things and, you know, be a member and it really only affects the way you vote or something like that.
Yeah.
I think they want more mm-hmm. or they don't want anything. That seems to be the case.
That's my question. I've been obsessed for the last several years of, you know, the numbers are trending very obviously down for the church. People who say they're nuns, they're no religious affiliation. It's plummeting right now, or going up, I'm sorry. And the people who are affiliated with traditional Christianity, evangelicalism, you know, whatever, that's plummeting. And I want to know how to get those nuns. I want to know how to show them that Jesus doesn't look like the church does in America in many ways. But I wonder, with those millennials and nuns who are walking away from the church in droves, are they attracted to the way of Jesus genuinely? Like, if you show them a real picture of the gospel, if you show them who mm-hmm. Jesus really is and what the incarnation is at its roots, will they be interested in that enough to say yes to it, I'm going to give my life to that? Or has our culture come to this point where we just love deconstructing so much that the thought of actually having a foundation of some sort sounds offensive?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I don't know that anybody that likes the idea of a foundation is going to find it in a sort of Kierkegaardian form of Christianity. Like, foundation brings to mind a thing that you can stand on, that it's mm-hmm. firm, that's unshakable, you can be sure about, that never really changes. And that's just not what people are like. And if God is a person, then being in relationship with a person, why would you expect it to have the nature of a foundation? So I'm just kind of riffing on something you said there. I'm not sure exactly how you intended it, but I really do think there's a possibility for offense for everybody in Kierkegaard's version of Christianity. Whatever you're looking for, God is probably not that. And that's kind of scary. That at the essence, you know, the core of Christianity is really something beyond what you have fathomed.
Yeah.
And probably what you're able to fathom. So like every time we grab a thing that we really like and we say, aha, this is it. I fathomed it. Isn't that beautiful? Isn't that good? Now we can present that to the world. That'll fix the problem of people not wanting it. Whatever we've grabbed isn't God.
Yeah, yeah. And that's where I want to say, I don't want to come off as saying, you know, the more you talk, Kyle, the more I think that me and Soren Kierkegaard would be great friends. But what I do, I am resonating with what you're saying, what Kierkegaard brought. When you're talking in this fashion, it makes me think of this thing that I've been fascinated with for the last couple of years as I got into my 40s, which is just this idea of mystery. Mm-hmm. That all of our language that we use to talk about God, we've talked about this, is metaphorical.
Yeah.
All of it, you can say. And that shouldn't be so scary if God really is the creator of the cosmos. If you just do a little bit of research in quantum physics and, you know, the astronomy and the origins of the universe, you'll quickly find that, like, if God really did make all that, then it's really hard for me to get a handle on that God. We have to make room for mystery in our experience. And that sounds like maybe Kierkegaard's going down that line or that thinking of mystery being more important than we think it is.
Yeah, maybe. Again, not an expert, so I don't know what his specific thoughts on mystery are, but I do think that from inside the orientation of faith, it's not scary. Mm-hmm. It's probably exciting because you know that at bottom, the world is loving.
And probably necessary, right?
What do you mean?
Mystery is necessary to have a real faith journey.
Sure, yeah. And you're kind of comfortable with your own limitation, with God's limitlessness and, you know, whatever. From outside that orientation of faith, so outside the gift of grace, you know, objectively looking in on it, trying to understand, I think it's terrifying. Mystery is by definition something beyond all of the things that could give me comfort. So
which in your saying knowledge equals comfort.
I'm saying the things that do in fact comfort me and just in my experience. So trying to think of this like an existentialist would, right? What in fact makes me feel comforted in my life? The answer to me, maybe you're different, is either someone loves me and I trust that that will continue, or I've understood a thing and I know it to be safe. Or maybe I know it to be exciting. It doesn't have to be safe, right? Because sometimes challenge is good. Sometimes risk is good. That's part of life that we want. But I know that there's like a limit to the risk such that it will be to my benefit in the long run. Those are the things that give me comfort. And if something falls outside of those categories, it's not actually possible for me to be comforted about that thing. This is why I disagree with Plato when he said that death is a good thing, or at least that we ought not to fear it because we don't know anything about it. I think it's perfectly reasonable to fear a thing you don't know anything about.
Yeah.
For the reason that you don't know anything about it. Yeah. And if God is by definition beyond my knowledge, then yeah, if I don't have the orientation of faith, then the mystery is terrifying. And the mystery, as you say, is necessary. The kicker is I can't give myself the orientation of faith.
Sure.
I can either accept it or not. And I think Kierkegaard would say it's extended equally to everybody.
Yeah.
So that's parts of choice.
Yeah. The reason that for me, mystery and embracing mystery has been a freeing experience and a comforting experience, actually, is because I feel like I've spent a majority of my Christian life trying to prove things. Like we started out this this episode talking about, I felt like it was my job, and I didn't even think of myself as an apologist. I just thought of myself as a good Christian who's trying to prove his faith and have a good answer ready in season.
Yeah.
And so I got to the end of that in many ways. Like I realized that I can't prove everything, and I realized that I don't have an answer for everything. And that's a crippling, terrifying reality to get to look in the face and say, I don't know. Or if I'm going to continue this, I'm going to have to fake it. I'm going to have to fake that I know. That was my experience for a long time. And when I just realized that I don't have to fake it, and because I don't have to know, because it's actually impossible for me to know. This is what faith is all about. Mm-hmm. And there's so like the vast majority that's real about God, I have no clue about. Because God's God, the divine reality, the ground of being. And my knowledge of the divine being, if it's real, if God's real, is so limited. And so that's actually been a comforting reality for me, that I don't have to have the answers. When my kids ask me these really, really hard questions that I feel like I need to go take more Bible courses on to answer, it actually frees me, and it gives them a certain amount of freedom and beauty to say, Daddy said, Daddy's the pastor who preaches for 40 minutes every Sunday, and he thinks he looks like he's got all the answers, and he just told me he doesn't know. That for me is a comforting place to live in, even though it's chock full of uncertainty. I think these are things that we need to get more comfortable with.
Yeah, agreed. I'm reminded of something. I want to say it was Julian of Norwich said, and I'm going to not get the quote right, but someone who, if ever there was a paragon of Christian faith, probably she was. And yeah, something along the lines of, after one of her visions, like the idea that the truth of the matter is none of us ever had anything to worry about. Like, you know, God in his infinite love has been behind the whole thing. And you can only kind of see that from the inside, and it's only a comforting idea from the inside. But hopefully seeing it from the inside, I find it an extremely comforting idea and a very hopeful idea. It makes me wonder what Kierkegaard would have said if he had lived to see the Pentecostal movement, you know, the sort of global spirit revival thing that happened around after he died, I guess. Because in many ways, I think that's really resonant with the kinds of things that he was focused on, an experience-driven faith that centers love and, communal unity and experience over doctrinal understanding or liturgy or anything like that. But he was a good Lutheran boy too, so I'm not really sure what he would have thought of that.
Yeah, interesting. Well, listeners, we bless you to embrace the actual way of Jesus, not the way of the American Jesus. We bless you to say, I don't know, and come to the end of your reason and find the beginning of faith. We bless you to find all of Kierkegaard's pseudonymic manuscripts and wrestle with them.
Yeah, good luck with that. If anybody wants to start with Kierkegaard, there's a good collection edited by Howard and Edna Hong. I think it's called The Essential Kierkegaard. I mean, it's not a short book, it's not an easy book, but it's the place to start.
Thanks for listening to A Pastor and a Philosopher Walk Into a Bar. We hope you enjoyed the episode. And if you did, please rate and review the podcast before you close your app. You can also share the episode with friends or family members with the links from our social media pages. Gain inside access, extra perks, and more at patreon.com/apastorandaphilosopher. We're so grateful for your support of the podcast. We'd love to hear from you. Drop us a note at pastorandphilosopher@gmail.com. Until next time, this has been Pastor and a Philosopher Walk Into a Bar.
I'm still recording, and I like looking at the waveforms. What? Come on. Yeah, buddy. Yeah, buddy. Yeah.
We have to cut him off.
Smooth transition out.